Okay, good morning, everybody. So I'm David and I are the only people in the building itself, and I'm glad that you're participating through Zoom. And I thought we would take a little break from Shemitah and spend this week and next week talking about Hanukkah, which is coming up. Truth of the matter is I have a lot of stuff on Hanukkah, so I may even talk about Hanukkah after Hanukkah, but at least we'll start now. And the question I want to discuss today is, Hanukkah is, of course, a rabbinic holiday. And even though we make the bracha when we light Hanukkah candles, Asher Kiddushanu b'mitzvasa v'tzivanu, that God commanded us, you know, that's a Devar Pashut. The Rambam explains that since the Torah commands us to obey the takanos of the Chachamim, so we make the bracha, Asher Kiddushanu b'mitzvotav, even on mitzvos that are drabanan. That's an old question that the Gemara itself says, that how can you say Hashem commanded? And the answer is, in the mitzvah of Lo Sasur, do not depart from what the Chachamim say. So every drabanan becomes a doraisa in effect. But if we ask ourselves, why did the Rabbanan enact a holiday of Hanukkah? The answer is not as simple as one would think. Most people instinctively say, oh, there was a miracle that a jar of oil was found that could only burn for one day, and miraculously it burned for 8 days. And that is why the Chachamim made a holiday of Hanukkah, to celebrate the miracle of the Pach HaShemen. In truth, we can see that that is actually not the origin of it. The earliest account we have of the whole Hanukkah story is a book that is not part of Tanakh. It's a book in the Apocrypha, the so-called Svarim Chitzonim. And this is either called Sefer HaMakabim, which is its literal official name, or sometimes it is called Sefer Chashmonoim. And the book of the Maccabees, actually there are four books of the Maccabees. There's Maccabees 1, 2, 3, and 4. None of them are part of the Jewish Tanakh, because they were written after the age of prophecy and are not considered divinely inspired. Interestingly enough, although it's not relevant to us, in the Catholic Bible, the Catholic Old Testament includes the books of the Apocrypha. So you can actually see the book of the Maccabees in a Catholic Bible, which you should not get because it has the Christian Bible, the so-called New Testament, which we shouldn't even call it New Testament, in it. But the book of the Maccabees, although it's not a holy book, is a historical work, and the Rishonim themselves quote it, so it is considered to be a reliable source of the story. And Maccabees 1 and 2 are the history of the Hanukkah story. Maccabees 3 and 4 are really quite different. They are really philosophical discussions. I mean, they don't really belong to the book of the Maccabees, but they're put there in terms of philosophy and proof of Emunah in Hashem and various other types of things. The original language of Sefer HaMakabim, it's not entirely clear. The earliest version we have is in Greek, and all Hebrew translations are modern translations from the Greek. However, some posit that originally it was written in either Hebrew or Aramaic, and that original got lost, and the only thing that came down to us was the Greek. Because of this, by the way, we have a little bit of an uncertainty what the word Maccabi means. As you undoubtedly learned in elementary school, even, there are two interpretations why the Chashmonoim were called Maccabim. Now, again, let me just clarify some terminology. Is there a difference between Chashmonoim and Maccabim? And what do the two terms precisely mean? Now, in the Al-Hanisim prayer that we have in the Amidah, we only refer to Chashmonai Ubanav. So it's very, very clear that Chashmonai was the family identification of the group of Kohanim, the patriarch of whom was Matisyahu, who waged a guerrilla war against Yavan in order to establish and defend the primacy of the Torah. Now, Chashmonai, therefore, was the family identification of this group of Kohanim. It was not the name of the army. It was not the name of all of the Chayolim who fought. It was limited to that family. Now, in its origin, Chashmona was actually a place, although by the time of the Book of the Maccabees, Matisyahu was living in Modi'in, but the family itself originated from a town called Chashmona, which is referred to in Tanakh, and therefore they were called Chashmonaim. And later, when they established a dynasty, it's called Malchus Chashmonai, or the Hasmonean dynasty. Okay, some give a different etymology. Some point out that in Tehillim, it talks about Chashmanim, not Chashmonaim, Chashmanim. And in fact, in Ma'osur, it says Chashmanim. Yevanim nikmetsu alai. Azai bimei chashmanim. That's taken from Tehillim. And chashmanim means the noble ones, the great ones. So some say chashmonaim is a corruption of chashmanim, and it refers to the nobility, it's the spiritual nobility and the greatness of these people. But be it as it may, chashmonaim is the name of the family. Makabim was the name of the army. The soldiers who fought with the Chashmonaim went with Maccabim. Now, the title originated from one of the Maccabees, the most famous of the Chashmonaim, Yehuda HaMaccabi, right? We have a street in Yerushalayim. But from him, it spread to the whole army. So it's no longer a family designation. It is referring to the army of the Chashmonaim, were called the Maccabim. Now, what does Maccabim mean? What does Maccabi mean, besides being a Kupat Cholim here in Yerushalayim? So, as you know, there are two explanations of what Maccabim means. Some say it is Rosh Tevo. Some say it's an abbreviation for Mi Kamocha Bo'elim Hashem, Mem Chaf Beis Yud. Who is like you, Hashem, among all of the other gods or powers in the world? A phrase, of course, that is taken from Uz Yashir in the Torah. And it is said that on the banner of the Maccabim, there was the Mi Kamocha Ba'ilam Hashem in Rosh Tevot, Maccabi, and that is how they got the name. The other interpretation of Maccabi is that it comes from the Tanakh word Makevet. Makevet means a hammer, a smashing hammer, and it refers to the military prowess of the Maccabees, who were really an untrained, non-professional army, against the Yevanim, who were the most powerful empire in the world at the time. Now, there's a nafkamina, whether it's Mi Kamocha Ba'ilam Hashem, or whether it's Makevet, and that is, do you spell Maccabi with a chav, or with a kuf? Because Mi Kamocha Ba'elam Hashem, you would spell it with a chaf or a kuf. Makevet, which means hammer, is with a kuf. So why don't we just look at the book? So the Book of the Maccabees does not give any explanation for the title. It just says they were called Maccabim. So why don't I just look and see how the Book of the Maccabees spells it? Answer, because I don't have the Hebrew original. I just have the Greek. And the Greek has the word Maccabi, but I can't tell from the Greek whether the Hebrew would have been a kuf or a chaf. So as I say, you can certainly get a Hebrew translation of the Book of the Maccabees, but it is all a translation from the Greek. And in fact, I think the oldest translation we have is only around 200 years old, the Hebrew translation. It's relatively recent. We do not have a Hebrew original, although some historians assert that there was a Hebrew original that got lost. So that's the Maccabees. Now, so Chashmonaim are the family, Maccabim are the army. So in the Book of the Maccabees, we are given Maccabees 1 out of 4, we are given a very, very detailed history of the struggle of the Maccabees, starting, of course, with the reign of Antiochus. And again, in order to put that in perspective, I have to go a little further back here. And that is, let's go to the end of the biblical period. The last events in Tanakh, fundamentally, are essentially the dedication of the Bayit Sheni in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. And then we are given the Kohanim Gedolim, who served in the early years of the Bayit Sheni. So the Tekufat HaMikra The period of the Nach, of Tanakh, ends essentially with the dedication of the Second Temple, going a few years later. And of course, that corresponds to the cessation of prophecy. Prophecy stopped. The last prophets are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and they were the prophets at the very beginning of the Bayit Sheni. That is the end of Tekufat HaMikra. However, shortly after the Tekufat HaMikra, there was a great, great event that happened in the ancient world, and that is the empire of Alexander of Macedonia, known in history as Alexander the Great, and in our tradition is known simply as Alexander Mokdan, conquered the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire had dominated Eretz Yisrael, right? Remember, the Second Temple was built under the under Persian rule. Koresh, Cyrus, had allowed us to come back, but the actual Persian king who authorized the building of the Beit HaMikdash and under whose reign it was completed was Darius II, who Chazal tell us was actually the son of Achashverosh and Esther. So Darius II was actually a Jewish king, although it's not entirely clear, did he think of himself as Jewish? Again, we're not really clear about what his own self-identity. I mean, did Darius wear tefillin, for example? You know, what did he think he was? It's not clear, but it is a sweet irony that the monarch of Persia, who allowed the Binyan Beit HaMikdash, was technically a Jew. But shortly after Tekufat HaMikra, towards the very, very end of the reign of Darius II, Alexander of Macedonia conquered the entire Persian Empire, which of course included Eretz Yisrael, and he established what is called the period of the Yevanim. So the period of the Yevanim is after the biblical period, although there are many prophetic references to it. So for example, in the book of Daniel, it talks about the four kingdoms. In fact, it even talks about Rome, which was far in the future. But historically, this is all afterwards. I don't know. Well, obviously, historically, it fits. Historically, the end of Nevuah is around the time of the Greek conquest. Yeah. I mean, the Greek conquest was very, very early in the years of the Bayit Sheni. Very, very early. Now, Alexander was a very, very interesting figure. Alexander was the son of Philip of Macedonia. And Macedonia was, as it is today, is there a country Macedonia? But whatever it is, but you know, it's a very small country, not particularly big. And Philip did not have a particularly big empire. But Alexander was educated with the best education a person could have. It just shows you that with money, you can get anything. His private tutor was none other than Aristotle himself, who is considered to be, other than Ar Chachamim, the most learned person in the world, basically. In fact, the Rambam many centuries later said that Aristotle reached the highest level of wisdom that one could reach short of prophecy itself. But, you know, Aristotle needed to make a parnassa as well, and presumably Philip paid him. And Alexander was not only a brilliant student, but a brilliant soldier, a brilliant military strategist. And from little Macedonia, he eventually wound up conquering the entire known world. As many of you know, he died a very young man. He died around the age of his early 30s. In Africa, he had died of a plague. But the legend has it that he died of a broken heart because he was only 31. And he said he has no more worlds left to conquer. There are a few stories in the Gemara about Alexander Macedon. One story involves a very interesting debate that he had with a group in Africa that seemed to be described as female Amazons, in which they kind of bested him in philosophical discussion and the like. And then we have the famous story that at some point someone convinced him that the Jews in Jerusalem wanted to rebel, and the temple was the focal point of his rebellion. And therefore he decided he would go and destroy the temple and put down the rebellion. And the Kohen Gadol at the time was the great Shimon HaTzadik, who says in Pirkei Avos that the world stands on three pillars: Torah, Avoda, Gemilut, Chasadim.
And when Shimon HaTzadik went to beg Alexander to have rachamim, Alexander got off his famous horse and he got on his knees and he bowed down and he said, "You are the man who appears in all of my dreams, telling me whether I will be victorious or not. You are a man of God." And because of that, Alexander spared the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. He let the Beis HaMikdash stay. And the Gemara in Yuma records that to commemorate that great joyous event, Jews named all of their boys that were born that year with the name Alexander. And that is how Alexander became a Jewish name. To this very day, you can name your son Alexander. That's called a Shem Kodesh because Chazal incorporated it. And a person could be called to the Torah by the name Alexander. And the Gemara traces it to that particular event. So Alexander the Great had a huge, huge, huge empire. He took over the Persian Empire and conquered other countries, even outside of the Persian Empire as well. But in many, many ways, Alexander was not Greek. Alexander was Macedonian, but Alexander was a devotee of Greek philosophy, culture, athletics, mathematics. After all, he was trained by Aristotle, who is the man, so to speak. And Alexander had this vision of creating a very homogeneous empire. The idea, the term that we use called Hellenism, the spread of Greek culture, was really the vision of Alexander the Great. Unlike, for example, Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar did not care for cultural uniformity. You know, you could do your he wanted people to bow down to him, so to speak. But he didn't care if you had your unique dress, your different language, your different cultures. He really didn't care. He just cared for domination, power, money, whatever it would be. But the concept of cultural homogenization was really Alexander's vision. And again, I'll even say that he had good motives. He saw Greek wisdom as the highest form of understanding, and he wanted to spread it everywhere. And thus we find that throughout Alexander's empire, now Eretz Yisrael will be included, the concept was there were stadiums, there were athletic events, there were lyceums, meaning philosophical schools, Greek art, culture, music. Hellenism spread very, very widely. One of the cities that he founded a city in Egypt, and he named it after himself in his lifetime, called Alexandria. And Alexandria had a huge, huge Jewish population. But they were largely assimilated. They were largely Hellenistic. In fact, the Gemara in Megillah discusses, can a Sefer Torah be written in Greek? And the Gemara has a different question. And one wonders, why on earth would there ever be a Sefer Torah? I mean, who would think of writing a Sefer Torah in Greek? And the answer is that it's really referring to Alexandria. Alexandria was so assimilated that there were very, very few Jews who were able to read Hebrew. The famous philosopher Philo of Alexandria, who, again, the jury is still out. Was he totally an observant Jew or not? I mean, he certainly looked at tradition in a favorable way, but we're not really clear, if he wore tefillin or whatever it would be. But some posit, again, this is a very uncertain, but some posit Philo himself did not understand Hebrew. He got his understanding of the Torah from the Septuagint, which was the translation of the Torah into Greek by the 70 elders. So Philo, who by far was the most learned Jew to come out of Alexandria, even he may not have known Lashon HaKodesh itself. But as I say, that's a big machlokas. I'm certainly not asserting that as something that we know for sure. So the thing you need to know about Alexander is that the process of Hellenization under Alexander the Great was largely a voluntary process, not a compulsory one. Meaning to say, Alexander did not say Jews cannot keep the Torah, Jews cannot do mitzvahs. Rather, Alexander used what we would call in modern terms, he used the idea of the carrot rather than the stick. He was trying to show the beauty of Greek culture. And as a result, one has to remember this, even before Antiochus, forget about Antiochus, way before Antiochus. This is more than 150 years before Antiochus. Jews were assimilating. Jews were giving up. Jews were many Jews stopped keeping mitzvahs because Hellenization spread like wildfire. Just as, you know, in the 19th century, you had a reform movement where more and more Jews were giving up the traditions and the Masorah of Judaism. Hellenization was, in effect, the first century's movement of either reform or enlightenment, Haskalah, whatever you want to call it. So that included intermarriage. That included not keeping Shabbos. That included not keeping kosher. That included stopping circumcision so they could participate in the Greek athletic games, which were done in the nude. The Olympics were done in the nude and the like. So the problem of Hellenization is really connected to Alexander, not Antiochus. Antiochus had a certain spin on it, which we'll get to later. Okay, now, Alexander died at the age of, I believe, 31, in his very, very early 30s. There's some discussion whether he was gay or whatever it is. I mean, actually, some actually say, you know, who knows? Obviously, we don't have medical records from the first century, but some say he had something akin to AIDS all the way back then. But immediately, the question of succession arose because Alexander had no children. So his empire was initially divided among four generals. And of those four generals, the two of them are important for Jewish history. That is Ptolemy, that's P-T-O-L-M-E-Y, Ptolemy. In Hebrew, he's called, or in Aramaic, he's called Ptolemy. And he established the Ptolemaic dynasty. And then we have Seleucus, who established a dynasty in Syria. So essentially the breakdown would be this. Ptolemy had Egypt and North Africa, and Seleucus had Syria and Turkey, the part that's called Asia Minor. Now, if you can envision a map, you can now see that Eretz Yisrael is between these two empires. The Ptolemaic dynasty is Egypt, North Africa. The Seleucid dynasty is Syria, Turkey. And indeed, in the book of Daniel, there's a whole series of prophecies that talk about wars between the king of the north and the king of the south. And without telling you who they are, and most of them, of course, you understand that the king of the north is a reference to Seleucus, and the king of the south is a reference to Ptolemy. Now, what happened over the next 100 years is Eretz Yisrael is a football that is constantly going between the Ptolemaic dynasty and the Seleucus dynasty, because there was a constant, actually, technically, I wouldn't call it civil war because these were two different empires, but they were constantly at war with each other. Now, the truth of the matter is, on some level, the Jews didn't care very much who wins, because they weren't doing so good no matter who wins, who won, etc. But there's a whole series of wars. The one thing the Ptolemaic dynasty is known for in our Jewish history is that Ptolemy HaMelech, or one of the Ptolemies, they all, you know, it's hard to know because all of them have the same name. Ptolemy the First, Ptolemy the Second, Ptolemy Philadelphus, all of them go with the name Ptolemy, was the hereditary name. But one of the Ptolemaic monarchs commissioned the translation of the Torah into Greek by the 70 elders who were put in different rooms. And they come up with what is known as the Septuagint, which is essentially Targum HaShivim, the translation of the Torah by the 70 elders. Now, although these were chachamim, these were sages, the Septuagint is not regarded as that authoritative in the Jewish tradition, but the Septuagint had tremendous reception in the Christian church. In fact, many of the so-called church fathers, some of them knew Hebrew, some of them certainly knew Hebrew, but those who didn't know Hebrew essentially learned the Torah from the Septuagint. And as I indicated, even Philo of Alexandria learned Torah, perhaps learned Torah from the Septuagint as well. What's interesting is the difference in perspective between how Chazal viewed the Targum HaShivim and how the Alexandrian Jews viewed the Targum HaShulchan. In Chazal, it is said that when the Torah was completed in Greek, there were 3 days of darkness that descended upon the world. It was dark, it was unfortunate, it was tragic. And the question is, what made it so tragic? Why did Chazal look at the Septuagint in such a negative way? So there are, so the Gemara doesn't say. It's one of those things where the Gemara makes a statement, but we don't really know what its concern was. Huh? Yes, that's not in Megillah. So there are a few reasons. One reason is, oh, you're now making the Torah accessible to non-Jews who are able to introduce distortions and misinterpretations. But that's a little difficult because Moshe Rabbeinu himself wrote the Torah in different languages. Okay. A second idea was that it was a chaval that Jews were so illiterate in the Lashon HaKodesh that they needed to rely on these translations. I remember when the Art Scroll came out with their very first book in the 1970s, which was Megillas Esther. Right. And it was very interesting. Rav Meir Zlatowitz, Alav HaShalom, was a graphic artist, and essentially Art Scroll did invitations on kesubos. He had a good friend who was Nifter, so he thought, L'zecher Nishmato, by the Shloshim, I think it was, he wanted to put out a commentary on Megillat Esther, and it was intended to be a one-time book with no follow-up, and after that, he would go back to invitations and kesubos. And it was so popular that Art Scroll became Art Scroll. And really, Rav Zlatowitz and Rav Sherman have the credit of being one of the greatest Marbitzei Torah in the history, mamish, the history of the world. That's correct. Dafyomi has grown exponentially, primarily because of the Art Scroll Shas. It's quite amazing. I wonder if the Dafyomi Yerushalmi will grow because there's Art Scroll doing Yerushalmi. There's a Dafyomi Yerushalmi that not too many people go to. Not that many shiurim, actually. But perhaps it'll also grow because of Art Scroll. So, you know, Yerushalmi is difficult. It's difficult Aramaic. You know, people like to knock Art Scroll. You can criticize this, criticize that. Yeah, of course, I have my own little collection of Art Scroll horror stories that I could talk about, omissions, censorship, and the like. But, you know, you cannot take away the magnificent achievement of what they've done. But the reason I'm bringing it up is I remember that when everybody was applauding the Art Scroll Revolution, somebody said in the Jewish Observer, remember the 3 days of darkness that came when the Torah was translated into Greek. In other words, we're grateful for the translations. We are overjoyed, but we're saddened that we need them. Because in an ideal world, people should be able to go back to the original and learn them. So that's a mixture of simcha and sadness. Gratitude mixed with sadness. Okay, so that's the Ptolemaic dynasty. So now we get to the Hanukkah story, which is around 180 BCE. So it's BCE, before the Common Era, around 180. And Antiochus is a descendant of the Seleucus dynasty. And in various wars against the Ptolemaic dynasty, Antiochus conquers Eretz Yisrael. So this is a simple question that, again, it's obvious, but people sometimes wonder, why do we call Antiochus Greek? Antiochus is not from Greece. Antiochus is from Syria. So people say the Syrian Greeks. Well, who are the Syrian Greeks? So I hope you understand what's going on here. Antiochus's empire was not a Greek empire at all, but it was founded as a succession to Alexander the Great, who established Hellenism as his dominant philosophy. And the Seleucus Empire, or Seleucid Empire, I think it's pronounced with a Seleucid, right? Has Syria and Turkey. The Ptolemaic Empire has Egypt, North Africa. they are called Greek empires because they are founded on the empire of Alexander of Macedonia. And the Hanukkah story occurs at a point in the political football when Eretz Israel is under the control of Antiochus. Antiochus was a great warrior. He was a great conqueror. The fact that he was able to conquer much land from the Ptolemaic Empire. Antiochus gave himself the name Antiochus Epiphanes, which is Greek for Antiochus the Great. And in some historical works, he is described as Antiochus the Great. But behind his back, people changed the language a little bit. This is even the Goyim. Instead of calling him Antiochus Epiphanes, he became known as Antiochus Epimanes, which, if you don't know Greek, means Antiochus the Crazy One. And here was his policy. He was committed to Alexander the Great's vision of what you might call Pan-Hellenism. He wanted Greek culture, Greek religion, Greek literature, Greek science, Greek music, Greek athletics to be spread throughout the empire. But the unique twist that he had was, if people were not doing it voluntarily, he would coerce them to do it upon pain of death. Okay, this was not Alexander's policy. Alexander did not enact any anti-religious laws. Alexander used the carrot rather than the stick. Antiochus was prepared to use the stick, including the stick of death, if that was the case. And in fact, it's very, very interesting. You know, we've had a whole bunch of bad guys in Jewish history. We had Lavan and we had Paro, and then we had Nebuchadnezzar and Sisera. But what's interesting is Antiochus is the first king in history who specifically targeted religious observances. In other words, to pass laws that say you cannot keep the Torah. And in some ways, in a perverse way, you could even say Antiochus was a very enlightened despot because he was not anti-Semitic. Unlike, for example, Haman, who wanted to kill every Jew. Haman is like Hitler. Hitler didn't care from, not from, religious, not religious. If you were Jewish, and by the way, he didn't even have to be Jewish because Hitler defined bloodlines by way 1/8. And, you know, if you had a Jewish father and you were simply a goy, you know, that didn't make a difference. You would be called a one half Jew. So Hitler didn't care about religion. Well, okay, that's another talk. Actually, he deeply cared about religion because his war against the Jews was ultimately a war against the Torah. But in terms of identifying the enemy, he didn't target religious observance. He targeted Jewish blood. And Haman was the same way, right? Haman and Hitler are exactly the same idea. We will lahashmid, we'll lahara. But Antiochus is very different. Antiochus is not anti-Semitic. Jews can have full political, legal, economic rights. They can run for political office. Every profession is open to them, right? There is no discrimination against Jews. The only thing is, he only had one condition. Give up what makes you different. Give up what makes you distinct. Give up your Shabbos and give up your kashrus and give up your circumcision and give up your Rosh Chodesh, which essentially is the Jewish calendar, which sanctifies the new moon and determines. Well, the middle.
It's ironic that Rosh Chodesh always falls
on Hanukkah. Well, part of it is because we fought to keep the right to have Rosh Chodesh. So you see what Antiochus is doing. Antiochus is not attacking the Jewish body. Antiochus is legislating against the Jewish soul. He says, just become like us and the world will be open to you. There will be no discrimination. There will be no limitations. All opportunities will be present. On the other hand, if you don't go along with the plan, we are going to kill you. Now, in some ways, Antiochus's fanaticism was almost unnecessary because the problem was, well, from his perspective, wouldn't be a problem. Jews were doing it on their own. Some have said although I'm not sure we have the exact numbers, up to 90% of the Jewish people. So Antiochus's coercion is really directed against a relatively small group of fanatics who are refusing to give in. And of course, with respect to that small group, he actually was not successful. So, in other words, the larger group didn't need the coercion. They were doing it anyway. The smaller group are the heroes of the Hanukkah story. Okay? So the book of the Maccabees, going back to the book of the Maccabees talks about how Antiochus conquered Eretz Israel from the Ptolemaic dynasty. It talks about his anti-Torah laws. And it talks about the courage of the small group of Kohanim. Again, Matisyo, Kohen Gadol, was towards the very end of his life. And he was encouraging his sons to rebel against this Greek empire. Do not allow the Torah to be trampled, to defend the Torah and the like. So it's very important to understand that the war of the Hashmonaim against the Greeks was not a war of independence for political reasons. It was a war to overthrow the oppressor so that the Torah could be kept. Now, if you think about it, this was such, on a superficial level, this was such a crazy thing to think about. The Hashmonaim are a small group of untrained people. They are fighting against the most powerful empire in the world. Their own population, in other words, the other Jews, think they're crazy, think they're fanatic. And yet, they had emunah in Hashem that he would give them nitzachon. So the book of the Maccabees describes, in which you might almost say excruciating detail, probably much more detail than most people are interested in, every single battle, every single skirmish, every single military encounter between the Maccabees and the Greeks over a 20-year period. This war took more than 20 years. This war took more than 20 years. Now, I'm told, I don't know if it's true, that to this day, the Book of the Maccabees is studied in West Point and in other military academies in terms of how to conduct guerrilla warfare. Those of you that are a little older, you may remember the Vietnam War that the U.S. was involved in. And although you can package it in many, many ways, but essentially the U.S. lost a war and they were fighting against unarmed peasants and farmers. And this is a classic instance of guerrilla warfare can sometimes defeat a very, very powerful army. And the historical precedent for that is the Book of the Maccabees, where the Maccabees defeated the armies of the Greeks. And I understand that in West Point, they studied the Book of the Maccabees for lessons about guerrilla warfare, military techniques, and hopefully developing counter strategies to be able to defeat them. Now, at one point in this war, at one point in this struggle, the Yevanim gained access to the Beis HaMikdash. And they didn't destroy it, but they desecrated it. By desecrating it, I mean the following. They set up idols in the Beis HaMikdash. They sacrificed pigs on the Mizbeach to Avodah Zarah. They set up houses of prostitution. Some of that is actually connected to idolatrous rites, sacred prostitutes, and the like. And it's interesting that Antiochus did not destroy the Beis HaMikdash, but instead he desecrated it and violated it. Why didn't he just destroy the Beis HaMikdash? I think because he thought that maybe by desecrating the Beis HaMikdash, he would demoralize the Jews even more than if he would destroy it. This is a fascinating point. According to the Book of Maccabees, Antiochus's soldiers gained control of the Beis HaMikdash on the 25th of Kislev. On the 25th of Kislev. In other words, that'll become a holiday 3 years later, we'll see. But at that point, the 25th of Kislev would now become a very sad and tragic day, like a Tisha B'Av, the day the Yevanim got control of the Beis HaMikdash. And for 3 years, they had control of the Mikdash, which they continuously desecrated and contaminated. 3 years to the day on the 25th of Kislev, the Chashmonaim and the Maccabim liberated the Beis HaMikdash, and that is the basis of establishing the Hanukkah holiday. So it's very, very fascinating. According to the Book of Maccabees, it is literally a three-year window, 25th of Kislev to 25th of Kislev. Okay. Now, the Book of the Maccabees tells us that when we regained access to the Beis HaMikdash after 3 years, and we cleaned the temple, and we rededicated the temple, and we purified the temple from all of the tuma, and we removed the idols and destroyed them, Chazal enacted a holiday to commemorate the rededication of the temple. Now, this is very significant. In the Book of the Maccabees, it does not mention a jar of oil. It does not mention lighting the menorah that burnt for 8 days. If you ask me, why does the Book of Maccabees say there was a holiday of Hanukkah? Because the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash was 8 days. Now, in some ways, this is very, very logical. Because after all, what does the word Chanukah mean? Some break it into two words, Chanu, Chafei. They rested on the 25th. Okay, but that's a drash. In terms of pshat, Chanukah means dedication. Now, why was the dedication 8 days? Very simple. Because the Mishkan of Moshe, the Mishkan was dedicated for 8 days. Now, this is a little interesting because the Mishkan had 8 days of dedication. Shlomo HaMelech's Beis HaMikdash was 14 days. So it's interesting. One could ask the question, I have a partial answer of this. One could have a question, why when the Bayit Sheni is being rededicated, they chose an 8-day dedication ceremony rather than the 14-day dedication ceremony. But I think there's a beautiful answer based on the Medrash Pesikta. The Medrash Pesikta actually says that the Mishkan that Bezalel constructed in the Midbar was actually finished in Kislev. And the Mishkan should have been dedicated in Kislev. But Hashem said, I want to defer the dedication to the month of Nisan, because Nisan is the month of Geula, the month of redemption, and I want to connect Mishkan to redemption. So the month of Kislev complained and said, you've taken away the dedication from us. So Hashem promised there will be a dedication of the Mikdash in the time of Hanukkah. Now, right. So now we understand it. Hanukkah is a makeup for the lost opportunity of dedication of the Mishkan of Moshe. That is why, how long is the dedication going to be? The same number of days as the dedication of Moshe. So the point I want to make is this. I'm going to have to continue next week. The point I want to make is this. In the Book of the Maccabees, the holiday of Hanukkah is not connected to the miracle of the Pach HaShemen. The holiday of Hanukkah is connected to the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash after it was contaminated and desecrated by the Yevanim for a three-year period, and therefore it commemorates the ability to reestablish the mitzvos with Kedusha. Now, with this understanding, we have a very simple answer to one of the most famous kashas in Jewish literature, and that is the famous question of Rav Yosef Karo, the Beis Yosef's question, that if they found enough oil for one day, and the miracle was that the menorah burnt for 8 days, then only 7 days is a miracle. So why is Hanukkah an 8-day holiday? Hanukkah should only be a 7-day holiday. This is the Beis Yosef's kasha. There are at least 500 answers to this kasha because I have a sefer that has 500 answers. But according to the sefer, the Book of the Maccabees, it's very simple. The reason Hanukkah is 8 days is not because of the miracle of the oil. Hanukkah is 8 days because the Chanukah Tabayit was 8 days. And why was the Chanukah Tabayit 8 days? Because it was 8 days in the time of Moshe when they dedicated the Mishkan. Now, again, be sure you understand me. I'll get to where the miracle of the oil came into next week. I'm not suggesting that the Book of the Maccabees denies that there was such a miracle. Some historians like to say that, oh, it was made up later. No, there was such a miracle. But all I'm saying is that was not the reason for the original establishment of the holiday of Hanukkah. Okay, and based on the Book of the Maccabees, this gives us a good swara why it was an 8-day festival. And this answers the kasha of Rav Yosef Karo. Now, the other thing to remember, if you've been following me, I said that we regained the Beis HaMikdash after 3 years, but I said earlier that we were fighting the Yavanim for 20 years. How do I reconcile those two statements? So here is something that a lot of people don't realize. The dedication of the temple on Hanukkah and for 7 days after Hanukkah, after the 25th, was not the end of a struggle. We regained the Beis HaMikdash after 3 years, and that was a tremendous, tremendous thing. But we continued to fight the Yavanim for another 20 years. So Hanukkah is not the end. Hanukkah is actually the beginning. Kind of like Yom HaTzmaut, really. Yom HaTzmaut didn't end a war. It started a war of independence. And the like. Okay, so next week, Mr. Shem, we will talk about where did the Pach HaShemen come in? What's the source of it? It is not from the Book of Maccabees, and why do we emphasize the Pach HaShemen today more than the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash and the military victory? So I want to wish everyone a Freilich HaChanukah, Chag HaOrim Sameach, and may the light of Hanukkah come into our hearts and elevate us and give us Kirvat Elokim. So be well, Shavuot Tov.